All right, to put it basically, I've been hit about seven times here. Been deprived of sleep for many nights, the most of which was about four nights straight. I don't remember what I did wrong. I think I might have thrown a rock at some kid. I've been deprived of food.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys so much for listening. And if you get a chance, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It means so much. It helps the show grow. And it makes me feel like $1 million. So much so that the first take of this intro, I sang it, but I asked Greg to delete it. You will never hear it. It is buried and deleted in Greg. That's divorce country if you release that.
Divorce country.
Anyways, I love you guys. Now, let's get into this case. And trigger warning. This case deals with the abuse of children, sexual abuse, though I really don't go into it, and substance misuse disorder. So please take care when listening.
The search warrant showed the 12-year-old boy's body was already stiff by the time first responders arrived. His pants and underwear off, laying next to his shoulder, his knees bent toward the sky.
To let you know, they did break my nose. It's a little crooked right now. I had to set it when I was on top of Taffa when the embassy came to hide us. Got hit in the face by one of the staff who had already been rehired because he got fired for hitting another kid.
A deputy see the other children who were in the hut where the boy died, blocking Child Protective Services social workers from having access and withholding their full names.
This is the tragic story of several lives hit by confusion, misled by an ill-equipped leader who also suffered tragedy and angst within his own life, and parents who were left wondering, what did I send my child to? This is the negligent world of Steve Cardozano, in the world he created that spiraled into hellish teen camps that still exist today. Sources for this episode are Netflix's Hell Camp, the New York Times, Variety, Deseret News, and High Country News. Today we venture to Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument to understand how Hell Camp earned its name. We've heard the stories of these teen camps. Hell, I think I even did 3 parts on them back in 2020. But this one takes on a different meaning, because the man who began the camp, perhaps the pioneer and inspiration for every troubled teen camp that still exists to this day, the difference is that this man was unrelenting in reinventing himself and keeping this hard-nosed boot camp money-making empire alive. And in the words of his widowed wife, quote, "It was like he thought he couldn't do anything else," end quote. It was the 1980s. It was a perfect storm, the perfect breeding ground for this type of institution to emerge and flourish. The war on drugs was in full swing. Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan were warning parents and youth that this was an epidemic and anyone could fall victim to it. But what happens when, sure, there are kids acting out, doing drugs, robbing people maybe, getting arrested? Not great. You know, terrifying for a parent. But what happens when the same tough love given to them is given to a kid who maybe lost their parent? Their parents went through a divorce. They were struggling with an eating disorder or were just depressed. Number one, should those two groups of kids be mixed and treated the same? Maybe. Maybe it could help all understand life a little more, but should the ones not committing crimes be treated like criminals? Likely no on that one. But should the child criminals or ones experimenting with drugs be treated like that as well? Or should they be treated in a way that tries to understand why they are acting out, not pushing them further into a darker path? Imagine waking up in the middle of the night to 2 burly mountain men at the foot of your bed. They rip you out of bed. You're just a teenager. Maybe you had been on a bad path. Maybe you were just depressed, struggling in school. Maybe you were struggling with an eating disorder, like I said, or identity issues or sexuality issues. But nonetheless, you wake up terrified and are forcefully thrown into a vehicle and not given any explanation as to where you are going. The people in the cars have names like Mad Dog and Horsehair. What the fuck is going on? The next morning, you wake up on the desert floor in Utah, surrounded by other teens, many who look extremely malnourished. And that malnourishment is confirmed when a kid approaches you and asks you for the gum you were chewing. You hesitate and tell them, "But it's in my mouth." But they're so hungry, they say they don't care. So you give it to them. What type of hell did you just get dropped off at? So you're in this remote desert in a state you've never been to. Sure, you'd been acting out or struggling. And then a man by the name of Horsehair, former military, just like the founder, Steve Cardozano, was. And this man, who's huge, is yelling at the group of teens, saying stuff like, "I own you now. And you're going to go on a 500-mile forced hike across the Utah desert." You just woke up in an alternate universe with no explanation as to why, and no one asked your permission. You were a kid, I guess you'd think. I guess I don't have rights. Meanwhile, you have no idea that your own parents have signed away their parental rights to these men for at least the next 63 days. Sign the parental rights away. And in the case of Nadine from the Netflix doc Hell Camp, the only explanation she gets after being awoken in the middle of the night, flown on a private plane with these strangers, which, Jesus, how much money did the parents spend, to a remote desert, and all you're handed is a note by the kidnappers from her parents while she is scared and confused, a note written on a discarded bill envelope saying, "This is for the best, Mom and Dad." She felt more discarded than that sad piece of paper her parents decided to let her know her world had been turned upside down. So many parents that have regrets. So many kids that have resentment now. The plan? Force these kids on a 500-mile hike across the Utah desert. Give them tough love. But think about this. Their rules were also in direct opposition to being a good person. Their rations were slim to none. And one rule was, if you share your food with a hungry camper, you'd then go without. Is that the kind thing to do, to share with others? Shouldn't that be? Share with others who are struggling, even if it's just a quarter or a half of your food. But you're teaching these kids ruthless tactics. Share your food and you'll be punished, essentially becoming a ruthless taker and selfish member of society. Not a way I'd want to raise my kids. And if you steal food, now stealing is different, obviously, but if they stole food, granted, they were starving, but if they stole food, they would be tied by their hands and feet. It's almost barbaric in nature. They were not given basic amenities. Granted, the girls were obviously given tampons, but if they needed to tie their hair up for this 500-mile hike, they were using the tampon strings to tie their hair up. They were malnourished. They had to use their t-shirts for toilet paper, sleep on the ground, endure over 100-degree heat as they hiked through terrain that counselors had really no experience with. Horsehair is quoted in the documentary as saying, "The kids were so scared they almost passed out." And he says that was fine by him. It's either this or they're going to jail. The concept was coddling them wasn't going to change them. Tough love would. So it was a 63-day program broken up into three sections based on how long you'd been there and your performance and reform. The first level, they provided them food, but it was in a different location, so they'd have to travel there to get it, hike to get their food. The second group actually got a handcart to carry their gear and food and rations. And finally, the third group, after a month and a half or so, they were given a butter churn and a Dutch oven, easier ways to get food. But the kids were also shown how to kill and skin an animal. The founder Steve's vision was that kids need a rite of passage from childhood to adulthood. And that rite of passage usually comes with some sort of struggle. And in some cases, it worked. Or the kids were so brainwashed in the footage filmed, likely for the Challenger Camp marketing, that one girl doesn't want to go home. It really does seem that she's completely brainwashed, and this is where some of the culty behavior comes in. Here's a quick clip of that.
We're going to show you different ways of cooking. One is the pit. We're going to use the stomach to cook.
Okay, get ready to stir it. Get the meat in there.
So, he's the one that it just hurts, you know? I pushed my mom away, and I pushed my dad away. And then she wrote me this letter telling me how much she loved me and missed me and wanted me to come home. But I need to be here. And if I did go home early, it wouldn't, you know? All this effort that's gone into changing me would be just a complete waste.
Okay, they were going through a rite of passage.
Steve taught the staff to think that the kids were liars and manipulators, and Steve was often never there. He was in his big mansion making phone calls or taking phone calls and dealing with the finances and recruitment. So the counselors, some of them ex-Challenger Camp graduates, were left to their own devices and going off what Steve told them. So if a kid said they had a knee injury and couldn't hike anymore, they were called liars. If they said they were going to pass out from malnourishment or the heat, they were weak and needed to be pushed harder, sometimes putting a heavy rock in their knapsack, weighing them down more to teach them a lesson. And the kids were cold turkey taken off their medications. I mean, where is the doctor here? You detox people from drugs or alcohol if they are heavily abusing them. It is an actual medical issue that needs to be monitored. But he was cold turkey taking them off of that. And also, cold turkey taking kids off things like antidepressants or ADHD medication or whatever. I mean, I'm not a doctor here, obviously, but there's a video here you're going to hear a kid explain. You can't just take a kid completely off of an antidepressant that was, frankly, maybe keeping them alive. But Steve was acting like this omnipresent, all-knowing God. And I just feel so bad for these kids. They were ripped from their creature comforts, their medication that maybe their body actually needed. I'm not saying that the drugs or alcohol were good, but like, if a kid needs an antidepressant or ADHD medication, they need it. It might make their brain feel better. But he was taking it all away. And I do believe in the power of nature to heal. It's actually my form of mental health therapy. But you can't just throw kids in the Utah desert scared, alone, and hungry and take their medications away and force them to walk and survive on nothing while detoxing. And here's a clip from a behind-the-scenes video from another, not associated with Challenger Camp, but it's a good example of a similar type camp where a girl is explaining kind of the horrors of just having been ripped off of her medication.
4.5 weeks, I have been on medication for like 4 weeks. They say that I'm going to go see a doctor soon, but they've been saying that for 3 weeks.
What's it doing to your entire body? Taking all of your energy?
I'm going to get lots of trouble. I had a respiratory problem, and then I had a really bad sinus infection, and then I haven't been able to eat for like 2 weeks now because it's upset my stomach to eat, and I've lost like 3 kilos because of it.
Anything you want a girl to say?
I love you, Jeff. I love you, Jeff.
Me too. Do you want to say anything to me?
You won't get in trouble. They said, I don't want to. Amber said everything.
I don't want to get in trouble, honestly. I'm almost home. I don't want to get in trouble.
And it was a mixture of kids that needed to be treated differently for their different life circumstances. The first girl from the dock I mentioned who got there via private plane, she smoked pot and drank at parties occasionally. It had a boyfriend that was a known troublemaker in town. And one night, she got in a fight with her parents. She ran away to her boyfriend's sister's house. She was later found by her parents and the next day was kidnapped in the middle of the night, flown, and taken to the Utah camp. But not everyone was as privileged as being able to afford a private plane to take their kids there. Some people, some parents were so desperate that they literally leveraged their homes, sold their homes to save their kids and pay Steve Cartagena. But the wealthy also flocked to these camps. Paris Hilton, as you'll remember from our former series on troubled teen camps, spoke out very publicly, even towards Congress, about her experience. Though not at Steve Cartagena's camps, but he was the pioneer, and the camp in Provo, Utah she went to could have possibly been modeled after his. So rich people weren't immune to this scam. Paris claims to have been strangled, slapped, and showered by male staff members. But like I said, this doesn't just affect the rich. Scared parents leveraged anything they could to pay Steve and his staff to essentially abuse their kids into submission. But what they didn't know when they were sending their kids away, that it just wasn't a good plan. Steve and his staff did not know what they were doing. And whether or not Steve's intentions were initially good, he got greedy. And he may have gotten sloth-like in the fact that he didn't do the research or know the area well. An area where he himself had never hiked 500 miles or really spent much time there. Yet he was charging parents tens of thousands of dollars to sign their parental rights over to him and take their kids where he didn't even know what he was doing there. He was money hungry, I believe that. And perhaps the root of his intentions were pure, but they spiraled like people in power often do. The power and the money becomes too seductive that you can't stop, won't stop, and often escalate and leave others in the dust. Matthew, who appears in the documentary, joined Challenger Camp in 1990 at the age of 15. And his story is kind of extremely understandable as to why his mom sent her son there. Number one, it was marketed as a place where the kids could get help. Steve was a master at marketing. In fact, he had actually studied film in college, so when he needed to turn it on, the glossy advertising charm, he did it with a bang. So it's not crazy to think a mom at her wit's end would think this is the helpful last resort. Matthew was acting out, and in pretty major ways. He would get high or drunk, or just on adrenaline, jump off the local bridge onto passing trains. He experimented with LSD, PCP, alcohol, and had been arrested a few times. His mom was at a loss, and this seemed like the best solution. She was afraid he'd end up dead or in lockdown. And because no punishment mattered to Matthew at this time, she tried this. He hadn't been there long before he realized this was something he just needed to get through, and he would be able to be back home, have his McDonald's, have a beer, everything would be fine. His thought was, these guys can't kill me. I just have to get through this. They can't kill me, is what he kept saying to himself. And maybe he'd be an example of a kid that needed this type of tough love, but it didn't seem to work, especially once he put his foot down. And that they can't kill me mindset must have changed when Matthew suffered some extreme abuse at the hands of his counselors. The day Matthew decided to tell the counselors he wouldn't be hiking that day turned into a nightmare so quickly, but one that would stick with him his whole life. After refusing to get out of bed and hike, one of the counselors literally hits him. Then another counselor who was there told him to tie Matthew's feet together at the ankles, and then they started dragging him. They drug him over the rocks and sand of the Utah desert. And if it's anything like Colorado, there's probably a ton of cactus and sharp plants there. So they drag him about 10 feet, and he's in terrible pain. And they ask him, are you ready to hike? He says no. Coupled with the fact that he's in pain, overliving the Utah desert, but that was in even more extreme pain because they had drugged him. So he says no again. So they keep dragging him, actually scraping the skin off his back. And every 40 or 50 feet, they'd stop and ask if he was ready to hike. At this point, this kid needed to go to the hospital. And Matthew kept saying no. You're not going to make me hike. The next morning, Steve Cartesano actually came out to the camp, and he told Matthew to remember this was his fault. This is why this happened to him. According to Matthew, Steve said it was his own fault. Own fault, he was beaten and dragged. And then Steve just left. Matthew was then removed, and I'm not sure if Steve alerted the authorities or what, but Matthew was removed by state social services and taken to the hospital. And this put Challenger Camp on local authorities' radar.
We were just sedentary couch potatoes and put them out here in a harsh desert, and they weren't allowing law enforcement access to them. I just kind of locked that away in my memory in case I had to deal with a program in the future myself.
When the cops arrived at the hospital, they saw an emaciated kid with over 80 scrapes and bruises and contusions. And the doctor who examined him told the authorities that the contusion scrapes and bruises on his back and torso were in various states of healing. Meaning, this wasn't a one-time incident. Matthew was being abused by staff members of the program. His mother immediately flew out. Granted, the Challenger program put her up in a hotel, but after seeing the state her son was in, she whisked him back home. Horsehair, now in his middle age, says on the dock he was upset and mad at the staff when he heard of this, claiming to never think abuse should be the answer. Yet, he also says he's old school and believes in the occasional corporal punishment. He claims that he told the staff they would be dealt with if he found out about any abuse. Who knows? But this situation seemed to be a breeding ground for egos to get out of control, power to get out of control, and abuse to manifest, regardless if that was the original intention or not. And remember that girl that was taken there on a private plane? She said the program cost her parents over $16,000 in 1989, which is over $40,000 today. Steve grossed nearly $10 million in his first few years of the camp, and he was living a lavish life, renting Lamborghinis, buying a mansion. But that was all about to change. Everything changed. Well, definitely and heartbreakingly for one girl's family, and it's so hard to hear their pain. But it changed only for a couple years for Steve Cartesano, because he seemed to bounce back. But this family, I'm sure they never will. This is the story of the death of Kristen Chase, just 3 days into her time at Challenger Camp in Utah. Kristen Chase was born in 1973. She was a beautiful girl. Her mom and her brother appear in the documentary, and their heartbreak is still so palpable, decades later. Kristen was born to Sharon and Ronald Chase, and her parents adored her. Her mom talks about enjoying Kristen's big personality when she was young. However, as Kristen entered her teenage years, her family grew troubled by some of her actions, which they said were rebellious. And this happened right as Steve's Challenger Camp was gaining steam. It seemed a fix-all for teens' problems. So in the summer of 1990, Kristen was sent by her family to Challenger Camp in the Utah desert. The summer in that heat sounds like a nightmare. In fact, and I don't know exactly the distance from where I was to the Challenger Camp, but during our honeymoon in June of 2022, we visited Arches National Park, and I love to hike and I love to be outdoors, but I literally thought this was the most dangerous thing. It had to be like 110 degrees, but Greg wanted to show me the big reveal at the top so bad, so I forced myself to do it even though it was just so painfully hot, like painfully. There were times I felt nauseous and dizzy, but in the end, the view was worth it, and I was fine later, minus a terrible sunburn, but that was just about an hour and a half of hiking. Being made to walk 4 or 5 miles in the heat when you just arrived there, which Kristen did, and she probably wasn't much of a hiker before that, would be completely unbearable, especially if you're not used to it. But I mean, again, I'm an active person and have previously hiked in maybe 90-degree heat in Palm Springs, but even that was terrible. But over 100 is a whole different ballgame. So when Kristen woke up in the camp, and as part of protocol, she was told that her and other teenagers were going to be forced to walk across the Utah desert in intense heat and sunlight. I mean, even that sunlight and sunburn can just eat at you. It really isn't surprising that 3 days into the 63-day-long program, Kristen collapsed while hiking on the 50-mile mountain in Utah's Kane County. She was then rushed to the nearby hospital, but it was too late. Kristen's death was ruled to have been caused primarily by heat stroke in 1990, implicating the higher-ups involved in the organization. And her father really fought them. So did her mother, but her father really, really fought them. And despite the fact that Cartzano and many of his colleagues claimed that Kristen's health was already not the best when she came to Utah, again, so why would you put her through those grueling conditions if you thought her health wasn't the best? That almost seems like an admission of guilt to me, but I digress. But Steve's wife later claimed that he was devastated by Kristen's death and says, quote, "I'm sure there's a part of him that saw it as his fault because it was his program and he was the one bringing the children into the program. But he also knew that it was beyond his control." She goes on to say he did not spend much time in southern Utah, really at any point, you know, so I think he realized there was nothing he could have done, really, to have changed the outcome. I don't know, spend more time there before you make kids walk 500 miles? If you haven't spent time in the Utah wilderness or desert and don't necessarily know the elements, why are you expecting kids to endure exhausting and treacherous hiking conditions while they are so malnourished that they are asking for the gum out of new campers' mouths? But when Steve was acquitted of all the charges, including charges from other family members of child abuse and neglect, he triumphantly says to the press, "I am one happy dude. I'm going to go home, hug my children, hug my wife, and sleep for 3 days. Now I can get back to taking care of my family. For the first time in 2 years, I'm not going to have this hanging over me." Kristen Chase's family would have this hanging over them for the rest of their lives. So who is Steve Cartzano, and what does he do next? When Steve was a baby, he was given up for adoption by his parents and adopted by a couple that adored him. Yet his adopted mom would be heartbroken and devastated after raising this boy for 2 years and loving him. His biological parents filed to get him back, and they did. According to Steve, his mother was a heroin addict who spent time in prison and was killed when he was 17. His father was abusive and had an explosive temper. These changes and hardships caused him to struggle in his teens, but he claims his whole life turned around when he joined the military. He eventually went to Brigham Young, where the idea of intimidating tough kids into submission through outdoor survival came during this time studying at BYU in the mid-1980s. And he started the program not long after leaving college. The godfather of the wilderness therapy treatment was born. A special forces officer in the military and a BYU dropout. And in his words, a kid that grew up in the school of hard knocks. He was about to gross $3.2 million in his first year in the 1980s, which would be around $8 million today, all based on the philosophy of break the kids down and build them back up. Following Kristen Chase's death and the lawsuits from other families, he suffered 2 years of legal battles and Challenger being shut down. Steve then lost everything. His wife had been a stay-at-home mom in a 6,000-square-foot house and had to go work at Sears to help support them. In the documentary, his wife and his daughter, I mean, they kind of fiercely defend him, which I get. He's your dad. He's your husband. But they also showed a certain amount of frustration towards him because they weren't able to understand why, after all the turmoil, he couldn't give this gig up. But again, they do fiercely defend him. His wife defends the fact that he had to depend on the people at the camps to be running the operations when he couldn't be there. And it seems he was rarely there, but you hired these men. Some quality control could have been helpful, but hindsight is 20/20. Like I said before, his wife claims he was handling the operations, the recruiting, the bookkeeping, everything. Which was a lot when a business takes off at warp speed like his did, and grossed back in the 80s over $3 million in its first year. There's a lot of responsibility, though, a lot of money and a lot of risk in this business when you are dealing with the nature of this business. You're kidnapping kids in the middle of the night, having parents sign over their rights, forcing them to hike 500 miles on little food in 100-plus degree heat. But you weren't really paying that much attention? I mean, it's pretty crazy. But Horsehair maybe says it best in the doc. He said, "We got too big too fast, and I don't think we were ready for it." Because after the death of Kristen Chase came out and the other families began suing for negligence and abuse, even though he won in every single case, his wife wanted him to quit the troubled teen program thing, but he doubled down. She felt it's like he thought he couldn't do anything else. And he moved it to St. Thomas. He starts a new camp in the Caribbean, and he used his skills as a film student to hire actors to act out a day in the life of a kid at this camp, where the counselors are calmly and respectfully disciplining the kids. They are on a clean and beautiful boat. It looks like paradise, but with rules, essentially. This was used as a commercial pitched to parents struggling with their children, making it seem like a perfect, well-handled, and respected program. Interesting, he chose a place so off of the watchful eyes of the U.S. government. And instead of hiking, this was putting kids on boats, but they would also hike and camp in the jungles or literally drift off at sea for months. And besides the death of Kristen Chase and the sexual abuse you'll hear about at the end, perhaps one of the most heartbreaking moments in this documentary is when a young teen's dad visits him, surprising him at the Caribbean camp, and the boy just starts uncontrollably sobbing.
Well, what would you say to your dad if he were here right now?
I give him a big
hug. Well, better turn around.
Turn around. I mean, it's very emotional. I'm not a real emotional person, but that really got my emotions.
And I know you can't see it in that clip, but I encourage you to go watch Hell Camp on Netflix. This is probably 40 or something minutes in. The kid he's like a tall, handsome, athletic kid, and he's literally sobbing like a baby and can barely like stand up because he's so happy his dad's there. But later in the doc, him and his dad, who I think he still is possibly struggling with substance abuse, the kid who's now an adult, his dad does say coldly that, you know, he should have just left him there in the jungle because it didn't work, and claims that his son started using about a week after. I'm kind of summarizing here. The adult son corrects him, and this is decades later, and says, no, it was about a month. But still very cold and very sad. And it's not the dad's fault, but, you know, who knows if that camp is what troubled the kid more into addiction? There's really no way to know. But when his dad says that decades later, I can't help but feel for both of the dad and the adult son. You know, the science of how to treat addiction is just not there yet. Is it an issue of the heart where we lead with kindness and understanding? I'd like to think so, because the alternative doesn't seem to be working. But then the former also leaves families shattered and taken advantage of by their sick loved one. I really have no answer, except the world is in so much pain and humans are in so much pain. Often the addiction is just a symptom of that pain. Sorry for crying. I've lost friends to addiction. Anywho's will be. But it was just really sad to see that kid just like so excited to see his dad. And then, you know, the
I think it was, I think they said like $35,000 or something his dad maybe spent on this. Didn't work, you know, yet Steve was flying high. It's just a weird industry. So I don't know. There's got to be a better way, but I don't know what that is.
And we're thinking of changing the name of this podcast to Rachel Cries 7 times per episode. 7 deadly cries. 7 hysterical crying bouts.
No, it is what it is. Okay, moving on. So, meanwhile, during the St. Thomas era of Steve Cardozano's life, his own son, Dave, is spiraling into addiction. And when the St. Thomas camp gets shut down and the American embassy in St. Thomas has to come and rescue these kids, which, by the way, some of the attendees at the St. Thomas edition were the likes of descendants of the Rockefellers and the governor of Arkansas's own grandson. So after this, Steve tries to have a normal career after this. He does some handyman work and odd jobs, but eventually gets a call from a camp in Samoa asking him to be a consultant. So he jumps right in and heads to Samoa and actually has his own son, Dave, kidnapped and brought there to try and save him. It's tragic and ironic all at the same time. And while Dave is away, Steve's daughter, who appears in the documentary, who is now 13 or 14 years clean, begins hanging with Dave's old buddies, and she too becomes a heroin addict. Dave never did get clean, for a long period of time at least, and at the time of the documentary, he was currently in prison. And Samoa wouldn't be any better than the other two camps. One girl from the Samoa camp was not only tortured by someone she considered a friend, a kid she grew up with from California, where they were both thrilled to see each other at the camp. And I don't know that she holds, it's kind of hard to read, like, because it was so traumatic for her. They were friends. They were thrilled to, like, see each other when they arrived there. But he was kind of forced to participate in her torture. I don't know that she forgives him. She says, I know he doesn't want to hear it. And they kind of go back and forth, you know, in separate interviews. And he thinks that she understands, but maybe he doesn't know what happened to her later. Anyways, she was essentially tortured by other campers. One was her friend. And then she was sent to lockdown. And in that, she was abused by another counselor, sexually abused. And finally, in another sad and terrible twist of fate, a poor, sweet little girl, little teen, I guess, who was sent to one of his camps after attempting to take her own life after her father had died. She alleges in the documentary that Steve himself groomed and then sexually abused her. Steve Cardozano died in 2019 of cancer. He is survived by his children and his wife. His daughter, who spoke on the documentary, has been clean for 14 years after falling into drug addiction while hanging out with her brother's friends while he was away at the camp in Samoa. He is now in prison still struggling with addiction. Steve's other children seem to be doing fine by all accounts, and his wife is beautiful and appears healthy, but the trauma for their entire family, but also their unwillingness to truly face what Steve Cardozano created and frankly failed at, minus the millions lost and made again, has had a truly dangerous effect on the teen reform industry, possibly even rehabs, and the way we think about mental health and substance misuse disorder today. Substance misuse disorder is such a tricky and difficult and painful issue. So are issues of mental health, but it is not a place to feel alone, and there are plenty of places, but please do your research. There are helplines you can call. I don't want to give the names or numbers of them because, you know, you never know, but please, please do your research before trusting someone to help you. Your family loves you, and please take care. Your friends love you. You're gonna be okay, and I love you. So thank you guys so much for listening, and if you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts. Until next week.
Rachel cries again. Cry Strikes Back.